do you think there's a possibility that we could be open for business in the month of May?
No. No, Jim. No.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I
thought you might like some reality.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Not CNBC.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., in Red Bluff and Redding, California, on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE, in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, in Grand Rapids on WPRR, in New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, in Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF, including other fine terrestrial affiliates that we don't have time to mention today. Also, we stream coast to coast and around the globe, yes, even during pandemics, on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth. 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another edition of The Bradcast, your radio to quarantine by, and we are delighted you are here with us. So I am generally an optimistic guy. Would you agree, Desi Doyen?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay. You don't have to be nice. You could say if I wasn't.
Yes,
think I am.
Yes, you generally are.
Well, actually, I don't think I am all that optimistic, but that is what I hear from listeners. They write, they say, hey, Brad, how do you stay so positive in these bleak times? Well, those notes actually always sort of surprise me because I don't feel particularly positive, particularly when I'm on air, particularly these days, particularly with the stuff that we tend to cover. But I do continue to have hope that we can at least help to make the right thing happen. I see no point in cynicism. That is the laziest and most non-productive thing in the world. If there is a way to fix this mess, we should try to do so. And that's true about whatever the mess is, not just the current COVID crisis, but all of the messes. If there is a chance to fix them, let's focus on trying to fix them rather than, you know, how terrible it is. But I would rather find a way to make the positive thing happen, no matter how small the chances are, no matter how bleak the things may feel, rather than wallow in self-defeat and certainty that nothing can improve and that the entire game is rigged. Again, that's cynicism. Skepticism, fine. Cynicism, not helpful. If it is rigged, fine. I will work to figure out how to unrig it, and we will work together to expose the riggers and hold them accountable if possible, no matter how impossible that does sometimes seem. So I'm generally optimistic, I guess, in that I look for ways to make things better. Not to pretend that everything is okay, but to try to find a way out of the ongoing disasters. Now, that said, I mentioned this on Monday's show as the stock market was, for some reason, skyrocketing that day on the thinnest of potential good news regarding an apparent plateauing of the coronavirus death rate in Italy and a decrease of cases in Spain. And I think most directly that day would appear to be a pretty substantial fall in the reported numbers of coronavirus deaths in New York over the weekend. It all seemed, to me, pretty overly optimistic, certainly not enough to justify a surge in the stock market, where the Dow had rallied something like 1,600 points that day. I mentioned that it seemed like irrational exuberance, to cite the famous phrase from long ago Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. Well, the stock market jumped again on Thursday. Not 1,600 points, but still a reaction to more threads of seemingly encouraging news. USA Today reports, for example, the Standard & Poor's 500 gained 2.4% today. That is more than 23% it has jumped in the past 2.5 weeks. So the S&P 500 is on pace to jump more than 12% over the past week, which would be its best week since 1974, because, boy, there's a lot to celebrate about in the financial markets, right?
This makes no sense.
I know. But that death rate in New York that they were celebrating earlier in the week.
I mean, yay, all the dead people?
Well, no, they were celebrating that it came down earlier in the week.
Fewer dead people, but still a lot of dead
people. But now it has soared since the beginning of the week. So those numbers were sort of an aberration over the weekend, but that didn't keep the stock market from continuing to buy. Now, the number of new cases and hospital admissions in New York does seem to be slowing, and the death rate is a lagging indicator, so maybe that will actually come down over the next week or two. That would be very good. But the curve is still spiking in many places around the country, and businesses are still shut down, and schools are still closed, and the virus is still ravaging communities from large to small, from urban to rural, across the entire country, and yes, across the entire world. But the irrational exuberance persists, it seems to me, no matter what the reality seems to be telling us. And the administration, of course, and Fox News, of course, they are all too happy to forward that agenda, whether it is a fantasy or not, because, hey, you know what? It's an election year, and you don't win re-elections with 10 or 15% unemployment rates, right? So if words, I guess, could defeat the coronavirus, well, then we would be winning. But they don't. And we're not. At least not yet. Even as our efforts as a country to stay at home has, at least much of the country, has in fact helped to flatten the curve. But this is going to continue for a while. I would say no end in sight right now, frankly. But the administration, they have an end in sight. They'd like to pretend, based on some version of their reality, no matter whether it is true or not. Now, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, for example, said on Thursday that he believes businesses in the U.S. will be open again as early as next month amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Asked by CNBC's Jim Cramer whether the U.S. might be open for business next month, Mnuchin was all too happy to say, yup, it's all looking good, Jim.
Do you think with this, there's a possibility, if the doctors let us, that we could be open for business in the month of May?
I do, Jim. I think as soon as the president feels comfortable with the medical issues, we are making everything necessary that American companies and American workers can be open for business and that they have the liquidity that they need to operate their business in the interim.
Yay! It's all good. If we can only make it to next month, we'll be open for business. In May, let the S&P soar. Meanwhile, back here in Realityville, the coronavirus outbreak has devastated the U.S. economy, has prompted a massive wave of layoffs as businesses all over the country are forced to temporarily, we hope, shut down, and a record-shattering 16.8 million jobs have been lost over the past 3 weeks, according to new data out on Thursday from the Labor Department. According to the Washington Post, the surge of job losses continued last week, with 6.6 million Americans applying for unemployment benefits, according to the Labor Department. Overall, more than 17 million new jobless claims have been filed in the past 4 weeks, an unprecedented escalation in unemployment in the U.S. since the week that Trump declared a national emergency due to the coronavirus. The 17 million figure includes new reporting from the Labor Department that even more people filed for unemployment in the prior week, pushing jobless claims up during the week ending March 28 to a record 6.9 million. That's up from the previously reported 6.6 million that week. So This past week's 6.6 million may also be adjusted in the weeks ahead. So in the past 3 weeks, just to review, if you're keeping score at home, we had 3.2 million jobless claims, followed by 6.6 million jobless claims, followed by another 6.6 million jobless claims. The previous record for weekly jobless claims, since we have tracked such things, was in 1982 with a whopping 695,000. Not million, 695,000. We have never even broken a million in 1 week in modern times that anyone knows of. Now we've done it 3 weeks in a row, blown it away with 3.2 million, 6.6 million, and another 6.6 million. Which could be adjusted up next week once all the numbers are in. But yeah, we'll be open for business next month, no problem. Time to reinvest in the market. Janet Yellen, one of the world's top economists, said the U.S. unemployment rate has jumped now to at least 12 or 13%, which is the worst level of joblessness in the nation since the Great Depression. Chris Rupke, chief financial economist at MUFG Bank, in a note to clients, wrote, quote, "It looks like the unemployment rate is headed to 15%, adding, "This isn't a recession. It's the Great Depression, too." We're not hearing that much from administration officials, however, or even from the supposedly independent Federal Reserve, where its current chairman, Jerome Powell, selected by Donald Trump, said this today on a webcast with the Brookings Institution.
When the spread of the virus is under control, businesses will reopen. And people will come back to work. There is every reason to believe that the economic rebound, when it comes, can be robust. We entered this turbulent period on a strong economic footing, and that should help support the recovery.
Yeah, so we're all good. We got a strong economic footing, and when the spread of the virus is under control, maybe people will have any money at that point to spend it. But that robust economy does not exist anymore. No matter how much happy talk that we hear from the administration officials that apparently seem to be getting reflected lately on Wall Street, no matter how irrationally exuberant they may be there, relief is slow to reach people, if at all, people losing their jobs as states have been overwhelmed with unemployment claims. The Washington Post spoke with more than a dozen workers across the country who had lost their jobs, the majority of whom had not yet received any money at all yet. Even as hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions more, have not been able to even file for unemployment because of the many state websites and phone hotlines that are still impossible to get through. Florida started handing out paper unemployment applications this week because the state's jobless claims, their website, it kept failing. In New York, laid off workers are having to call hundreds of times to complete their applications. Spokesperson for Maryland's Governor Larry Hogan tweeted, "Understand that it takes approximately 25 to 30 minutes to file one claim." He said staff were working round the clock, but there was only so much they could do given the state received more claims in March alone than in all of 2019. The Kansas Labor Secretary urged people to keep calling. Delia Garcia said Kansas, like Maryland, has brought in more staff to help, but it's hard to train new people in a work-from-home environment. She said in a Facebook live chat this week, "No, we are not hanging up on you because we don't like you. We love you. We want to support you." Tens of thousands of businesses have closed because of shelter-in-place orders in more than 40 states. Nearly every sector of the economy is shedding workers, including manufacturing, construction, and even healthcare facilities other than hospitals. And yet, the Post notes, the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 400 points on Thursday morning as investors cheered further government actions to combat economic devastation. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin also said it's possible the nation could reopen for business in May. The stock market surge came after the Federal Reserve unveiled over $2 trillion in new lending to businesses of all sizes, as well as to struggling city and state governments. Powell said the nation's top priority is fighting the pandemic and caring for the ill, but that the central bank is doing whatever it takes to provide economic relief. And in fact, he means whatever it takes, including a new $2.3 trillion program that they have essentially created out of thin air to offer loans to companies with up to 10,000 workers, which they're calling, ironically, the Main Street Lending Program. We'll get to that in a moment with my guest as David Dayan of the American Prospect joins us again shortly. But the Washington Post includes some remarkable numbers in their coverage today for individuals who are feeling the brunt of this, you know, the consumers and the rent and mortgage payers who are losing their jobs in droves right now, the ones who actually drive the economy. So just to help put these unemployment numbers in perspective, this chart is amazing. 16.8 million Americans filed new claims for unemployment benefits. 16.8 million within from March 15 to April 4. So what, about 3 weeks. 16.8 million. Compare that to the number of jobs added in the past 7 years since April of 2013. That number, 16.6 million. So we have lost more jobs in the past 3 weeks than we have added to the economy in the past 7 years. The number of jobs in the 20, all of the jobs in the 20 smallest states combined is 14.7 million. So we have lost more jobs than all of the jobs in the 20 smallest states combined. The number of jobs in Texas, in all of Texas, which is the second largest state workforce, that number is 13 million. And again, we've lost 16.7 in the past 3 weeks, more than the total number of jobs in Texas. The number of jobs in New York State is 9.8 million. So not even close to the number we've lost. 8.7 million were lost during the Great Recession in 2008, 2009, 2010. 8.7 million. We've already lost 16.7 million. How many jobs have been added since Donald Trump's inauguration that he was so proud of? Well, 6.8 million. That is about 10 million less than have been lost over the past 3 weeks. And these numbers go on and on and on, and they are just gobsmacking. And yet you've got the Treasury Department chair out there saying everything's wonderful. And that, by the way, as the U.S. death toll was nearing 15,000 early on Thursday, with more than 430,000 confirmed cases, according to Johns Hopkins University, which may be vastly undercounting the real numbers. And yet, the market was up again today. We should be back and open for business any day now. And when we are, who's going to have any money to spend? Well, Mnuchin also says that you will, because some Americans will begin receiving their $1,200 relief checks in their bank accounts beginning next week. No
hey,
rush.
Hey, kid,
no
don't
rush.
Spend it all in one place.
Yeah, $1,200, that'll fix it. Someone, let Wall Street know that as soon as Good Friday and Easter are done, boy, is it time to buy, buy, buy. The money is going to come rolling in. David Dayan joins us next, and I'm just guessing, but he probably has the antidote to all of this happy talk, because he's usually even grumpier and certainly more cynical than me. That's next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
Happy talking, talking, happy talk. Talk about things you like to do.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Talking happy talk. Okay, last time when we talked with American Prospect executive editor and investigative financial journalist David Dayan on Monday, I was citing what appeared to be, in former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan's immortal words, irrational exuberance in the market over hints that coronavirus deaths may have been falling in New York. They have since sprung back up, but reported cases and hospitalizations are down. And enormous unemployment figures continue to roll in as Congress is now deadlocked once again over much-needed additional emergency relief funding for forgivable small business loans. And yet, with all of this, the market continues to rise as the administration happy talks about opening for business again suddenly next month, somehow. And as the Fed conjures its own $2.3 trillion out of thin air to give to larger companies through some program that they appear to be able to just invent out of thin air, no Congress needed. The actual data versus the happy talk and the Wall Street speculation seem to be completely at ridiculous odds, at least to me. But I don't know anything about the economy, frankly, other than what I read in data reports from the government and actual charts that suggest there is not much to be happy about, including information from independent economists describing what is now going on as Great Depression 2. Now, much of what has happened today in Congress and with the Department of Labor, jobless numbers, and at the Fed, I already knew about before today. Why? Why did I know this? Because I'm a financial and political prognosticating genius? No, because I read the indispensable, unsanitized report at the American Prospect, as I do every day, where David Dayan tells us what is going to happen before almost anybody else is discussing it, certainly in the mainstream corporate media. So no pressure, David Dayan, but welcome back to the broadcast, amigo.
All right. Thanks for having me.
I should note that that your unsanitized report, which is available via newsletter, which you can sign up for at prospect.org, covers more than just the financial aspects of the crisis. But that is certainly where you have been nailing it, David, of late, before most others, it seems to me. So please help me out here, sir. I keep hearing this happy talk from the administration, from Trump, of course, but even from Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, from Fed Chair Jerome Powell, even Dr. Anthony Fauci today seemed to suggest that it might be in the cards, in words that were forced on him by a CBS reporter, that we may, you know, see family vacations, summer camps, trips to the beach again by summer. The market continues to press back upwards, but all of the actual facts and data and jobless numbers and disastrous rollouts of the small business loans that were supposed to happen, and even the $1,200 checks that were supposed to go out to everyone, that seems to be telling a very different story from the happy talk. So who has got it right? Is this exuberance irrational, or am I just too much of a cynic to see it, David Dayan?
I mean, it's pretty striking. The S&P 500 closed today, Thursday. I believe it's closed tomorrow for Good Friday. Had its best week since 1974.
Right.
And this came at a time when, on Thursday, new jobless claims were 6.6 million.
Yeah.
On top of 6.6 million the previous week.
Yep.
And 3.3 million the week before that.
Yeah.
So you have, I mean, John Edwards used to talk about the two Americas, right?
Right.
I mean, those two sets of statistics couldn't be starker about the two Americas. Investors are, the you know, letting the good times roll, while ordinary Americans are losing their jobs in numbers with the speed that we have never seen before.
As I said, someone called it Great Depression 2 today, and which is why, you know, I see something like that, and then I see what the market is doing, and I see the, you know, the administration officials going on, and of course Fox News talking about how this is just all about over. We're almost ready to get back to business again. And I'm thinking, am I crazy, or are they? Is there any definitive word on which one of us are, I guess, crazier? I mean, who's got it right?
I mean, it's not just crazy, it's really dangerous. So one thing we're seeing is this kind of revisionism as certain numbers get revised downward based on what has been shown in data that I find to be corruptible and corrupted. The numbers of deaths do not correspond to the actual excess deaths over a normal year,
mm-hmm.
pretty much anywhere you go.
Right.
It's hard for me to say that the curve is flattening when we're not counting significant numbers of cases and deaths because people just aren't getting tested and people are dying even though they have symptoms of the disease. Because they haven't been tested, they're not counted in the official death statistics. I think there are a lot of things going on here. Number one, the data is inherently corruptible, and because of that, I don't know that you can make an intelligent prediction
mm-hmm.
about where this is going. So that's number one. Number two, what we know is, if you look to pandemics across history, that they come in waves. That we could open up the country, which Trump clearly wants to do, maybe in May, and let people out, and then people start contracting the disease again.
Yeah.
And we close it back up and
yeah.
let people out and close it back up. We're already seeing that all mm-hmm. over the world, in Singapore and in Vietnam, where they thought they had completely licked this disease. They are starting to put in orders to close up the countries once again. And so I think what we're likely in for is a series of waves. And what I really hope we don't get to is what happened in 1918 with the flu pandemic, which it petered out in the summer as the temperature rose and then came back more lethal than ever in the fall.
Mm.
And so that would be the true danger of a circumstance analogous to that. But we don't have enough information to know if that.
But we sure seem to be setting up for that with all of this talk of, we're going to be back. Everybody's going to be out and about next month, if not next month, then by summer.
I mean, I think we're certainly setting ourselves up to get out of here early and probably too early. And
mm-hmm.
and what that means is that, there's a lot of revisionism around these numbers. So like, we expected 200,000 deaths, but we got 60,000 deaths. And that shows that's like a normal flu season.
Right.
So why did we stay inside ever?
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't take into account the fact that we had 60,000 deaths even with everyone staying inside,
mm-hmm,
right?
Right.
If we didn't, there would be 10 times that many,
sure.
perhaps. And if we are premature in, firing along the checkered flag and saying, gentlemen, start your engines, we're going to be in a similar situation. And especially because the peaks are happening on different timelines in different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just open up the whole country if, Kansas is in a different place than Michigan, is in a different place than
yeah.
New York, is in a different place than California, is in a different place than Oregon. You this thing is going to come in waves in different parts of the country in addition to just the normal sort of move back and then dance around with the numbers going up and down until we get a vaccine.
Yeah, and which is one of the reasons that I've been, because I'm always trying to find a bright side here. I'm trying to find our way out. I'm a generally optimistic guy whenever possible. But I mean, I'm just looking at this and thinking this is crazy. There's one direction that a group of people seem to want to go in this country, and the investor class seems to be backing that up. It seems like they're the ones who are going to end up losing their shirts on this if their predictions don't come to pass.
Right.
But, unlike you, David, I'm not a finance guy, so I need your help here. The Fed announced the new $600 billion lending program for mid-sized businesses to help thousands of firms as part of a $2.3 trillion program in new funding actions by the Fed. Now, this is separate, if I'm understanding this is separate from the $2.2 trillion relief package that Congress passed a couple of weeks ago. This is the Fed's so-called Main Street lending program with loans to companies up to 10,000 workers, the kinds of companies you see on Main Street. They have companies that have up to $2.5 billion revenue. So Congress is fighting this week about adding an additional $250 billion to this Paycheck Protection Program, which is supposed to give out loans to small businesses with less than 500 workers. They've already allocated $350 billion to that program. But here, separate from all of that, is the Fed with $2.3 trillion waving a magic wand and creating this money with no congressional approval to lend out $600 billion to these large companies. Am I understanding that right? And how does that even work?
Yeah, you're understanding it right. And you know, I mean, this is really what we saw in the financial crisis. So there was TARP, the bailout program that Congress approved for mm-hmm. $700 billion.
Right.
And then there was about $12 trillion in other lending facilities that the Federal Reserve, for the most part, gave to financial institutions with little oversight, with no input from Congress or really anybody, and that was the real bailout. So, you know, there are sort of two bailouts that were going on simultaneously. You know, the one that Congress approved sort of hooks them in mm-hmm. to say, it gives them little leeway to say, hey, what are you doing, Federal Reserve?
Mm-hmm.
Because they all voted, you know, for this 96-0 in the Senate and by voice vote in the House with no even recorded vote,
mm-hmm.
they all voted for the corporate bailout in the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Fed adding things on, maybe that's where the real bailout is occurring. And of course, what we know about the what Congress passed is that $450 billion of it is going right over to the Fed to capitalize a new lending facility that isn't even this thing that you're talking about.
Really?
That no, this is a completely different lending facility that will be levered up to about $4.5 trillion. So, you know, between that and this, that's $6.5 trillion. And believe me, there's plenty more where that came from that has already been announced, that has already been put into motion. You're going to easily see $10 trillion in lending, if not much more, from the Federal Reserve. That dwarfs the size of you know, the $1,200 checks and the $600 boost unemployment weekly checks that we're seeing stumble along in the real economy.
And to be clear, that money doesn't actually exist other than the Fed sort of waves it into being with a few strokes of the computer, right? And says, this is how much money we are putting out.
Right. I mean, it's an increase in the Fed's balance sheet. And it depends on what the terms are, but it does usually need to be paid back. But certainly not at any kind of penalty rate, any kind of rate that you and I would be able to mm-hmm. find in our consumer lending markets.
Right.
It's a significant amount of help. Now, I mean, the difference between 2008 and today is that 2008, the institutions that were getting this largesse
mm-hmm.
were largely responsible for the downturn, whereas these businesses pretty much aren't necessarily responsible for the coronavirus. So there's a difference there in terms of, you know, the unfairness aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the proportionality of the response and you look at the neighborhood pizza shop or the neighborhood dry cleaner and what they have to go through to survive in this second depression,
mm-hmm.
and you look at what a quote-unquote mainstream business with 10,000 workers or
right.
what the airlines or, you know, some other large business, the velvet rope service that they're getting,
right.
it's obviously very disproportionate.
So I got a lot that I want to fly through with you here very quickly. We don't have a lot of time. But given all of this, why, given the ability of the Fed to just sort of create money, why then is Congress now bickering about, you know, how much to give out, about an additional $250 billion, which seems so paltry in comparison? Why are they bickering? Why are they doing this kabuki theater about responsible spending and, we have to, if we give this much to small business, then we need to give this much to this other thing.
Well,
what's that about?
This is very interesting. You bring up a very interesting point. So there are two things here. One, Democrats are trying to leverage the small business support, mm-hmm. which Republicans want, into more support for their priorities, increases mm-hmm. in food stamps, increases in money for state and local governments who are going to absolutely take it on the chin. There's a crash in revenues for those entities, tax revenues.
Mm-hmm.
So Democrats are trying to use some leverage here. That's the fight that's going on in Congress. But what you bring up there is very interesting. So let's talk about the small business lending program. The way that it works is that it's not the government but banks that are making these loans, which are forgivable if the recipients, the borrowers, mm-hmm. come up with a series of steps. The banks make the loans, and the Small Business Administration guarantees the loans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the banks were upset because they weren't going to get their money right away. They didn't want to outlay billions of dollars and then get the money back from mm-hmm. the Small Business Administration later. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to move onto what is called the secondary market. They wanted to sell these loans as soon as they made them.
Right.
To somebody else and let somebody else wait for the Small Business Administration to compensate them.
Right.
So the Federal Reserve came in and said, we'll buy the loans.
Right.
We will buy the loans, and then the Small Business Administration can work it out with us.
Mm-hmm.
Which, so take that a step further, right? If the Federal Reserve is going to buy up these small business loans whenever they're made by any bank, why do you need to appropriate any more money for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Fed can just buy any loan based on the demand out there in the marketplace. The Fed can just buy any loan that the bank makes to a small business under the same terms, and whether they lose money, quote-unquote, on those mm-hmm. loans or not or whatever, why does it matter? This is, once again, the entity that, through a few keystrokes, makes up the amounts that they want to spend.
Because they can can spend as much money as they want, so they can give out as many of these loans as they want, as much money as they want.
They can buy them from the banks. I mean, but however you want to do it, right? I mean, if you want the banks to be in charge of who gets the loan,
right, but that's what I'm saying.
There's
no limit to what the Fed can give to those banks for these loans. It doesn't have to be limited to the initial $350 billion. Therefore,
correct.
We don't even have to pass something in Congress to say, oh,
correct.
Let's do another $250 billion.
Absolutely. And that's my point. And you know, I mean, when you start thinking about that stuff, that, you know, you start thinking, well, why is the Federal Reserve so worried about these large businesses, about the banking system? And yet they've put this program together for small businesses, but why does Congress have to get involved in that and make sure that there's enough money to cover all these small businesses? Because I'll tell you, right now there isn't. So, I mean, if you look at the numbers of how much has already been lent out and how many businesses have benefited from that,
mm-hmm.
you get to roughly between 1 million and maybe 1.3 million small businesses that are going to secure this first tranche of $350 billion in loans.
Out of some 30 million small
that's
businesses.
Correct.
But don't tell Congress that, David, because, as you said, that's the leverage for Democrats to actually get things that, you know, actually help people if they can make a deal with the Republicans.
Right.
Who
maybe talking about this kind of solution with the Federal Reserve is harming the Democrats' leverage. But one thing I would say about that is they are using that leverage for a couple important features,
mm-hmm.
but what they're not using it for is to mandate vote by mail November elections
yes.
for every man, woman, and eligible voter in this country.
Thank you. That is their only leverage to do that. They tried to get $4 billion in the initial bill for that. That was taken down to $400 million,
that's
which is
right.
not nearly enough. And for some reason, I was going to ask, you haven't heard the Democrats either putting that in there as one of their conditions to pass anything at this point, have
it
you?
It isn't, and it's absurd, because what they want to do is they want to split now Phase 4, the fourth stimulus bill,
right.
not really stimulus, it's
mm-hmm.
a survival package bill. They want to split this into two bills. So you have Phase 3.5, which is the fight over the small business money, which they want to add a few things to, that does not include the vote-by-mail stuff. And then there's going to be a Phase 4, which may include vote by mail. But at that point, not only is the corporate bailout out the door, but all this small business money that the Republicans want to flow to Main Street businesses is also going to be out the door. So what leverage do you have left to even do a Phase 4 bill at that point? It's a mind-boggling strategy to me.
It is, and folks can read about it, I suspect, in the unsanitized report in the days ahead. David, has anybody actually seen any actual money yet, by the way, from that PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program? Has any of that money actually gone out the door to anyone? I think Mnuchin claimed some $90 billion has already been given out, but that kind of smells like a lie to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think his standard is that somehow it got into the Small Business Administration system. I don't think that reflects actually getting into the bank accounts of these small businesses. I think the thing's moving, or at least starting to move a little bit day by day, but certainly we're not in the place we need to be, and time is of the essence.
Yeah.
I mean, small businesses do not have unlimited reserves to sit and wait for the Small Business Administration to get its act together and get this money out. It's perilous, and a lot of small businesses are going to go under if they don't get the support in a matter of days.
A matter of days, and the same is true with people.
Much more true with people. What we heard is next week, the direct deposit will go out for the $1,200 checks.
Right.
So if you happen to have direct deposit on file with the IRS, you may get that money next week.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, it may be until August or September before you get that money.
Which is...
And with unemployment, I'm hearing a lot of horror stories about people trying to access state unemployment systems.
Right.
It's kind of a two-pronged process. You have to get on the unemployment rolls to begin with, and then you have to hope that your state gets its act together to get the extra $600 a week into every check. So far, I've only heard of one state, Minnesota, that has actually done this. And, you know, we're 3 weeks out from when the bill was passed, and you got one state out of 50 that actually has gotten the $600 flowing. And the interesting thing about this is there's an end date that's an actual date, July 30th, for the boosted unemployment. But if the beginning date keeps getting later and later as these state systems figure out how to get the money out to people, then it's less and less money that is actually getting out to everybody, and it's cut off at the back end.
As far as I can tell, we are at least conservatively a month into this crisis. In reality, at least 2 months into this crisis, at least. And I see none of this relief actually flowing anywhere, whether
let me correct you.
Okay.
Let me correct you here, because some of the relief has gotten out to some of course, the neediest Americans there are.
Who would that be?
The Dow Jones Industrial Average has gone up 5,000 points since the day that the Senate passed the bill. So let's not say nobody has been helped. We fed relief where we could to the people who this bill was for, and that's investors on Wall Street.
Yeah, first things first. By the way, there are I know there are some protections for businesses and homeowners with mortgages. Have any of these programs that you've heard of, David Dayan, have any of them focused on help for renters who are already having trouble paying rent to stay in their apartments? I'm just asking for a friend.
You know, what we heard from the Wall Street Journal is that about a third of all renters did not pay rent in April.
Mm-hmm.
So this is obviously dire. There are some very limited anti-eviction protections in the Federal CARES Act under they have to be federally backed loans.
Mm-hmm.
So if a landlord has a Fannie Mae loan or something, then those tenants can't be evicted for a small period of time, for like 4 months. There are also in the states a number of different regulations around anti-eviction, but I have not seen any rent freezes or rent cancellations in any state, really. And it's hard to know as an individual, mm-hmm. what your state has done. I talked to Richard Cordray, who used to be the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, mm-hmm. this week, and what he said is that he would like to see CFPB become a sort of information clearinghouse. So you could go to the CFPB site, put in your state, put in your zip code maybe, and find out what the rules are in your area around evictions, around rent, and things of that nature. I think that would be very, very helpful. But, of course, you know, the Trump CFPB has used this opportunity to loosen regulations on long-suffering businesses who are having problems in this crisis. So,
yes, the consumer,
you know, obviously it's a wrong-headed approach.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it's actually in their name, is, right. of course, looking out for businesses during the Trump administration. I'd actually hope to talk about that a little bit more. I'll point folks to prospect.org for your unsanitized report yesterday, talking about what Cordray had to say about the CFPB. I had also hoped, we ran out of time here, if I don't get to Green News Report, Desi Doyen will kill me, but to talk about Katie Porter's new findings that, in fact, the Trump administration had been encouraging exports of medical equipment and ventilators. And actually, we saw a huge increase in exports to overseas for the first two months of this crisis and a dip in imports. I will point you to theprospect.org for that. Lastly, before I let you go, David, and I do hope to continue speaking with you throughout the crisis here, can you offer us a preview of what you're looking at for tomorrow's unsanitized report so I can just throw myself out of the window tonight and save some time?
Well, you know, looking at a few things, talking about the phase 4 or phase 3.5 or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, looking at what private equity is up to in this crisis, the private equity firms have taken a large share of healthcare, and you can imagine how that's playing out. Mm. They have a number of hospitals and also hospital staffing groups that have ER doctors on the payroll. And so now during this critical time for our health system, we have these vultures who are in charge of a large portion of the health system. And that's going about as well as you would expect.
Fantastic. I'm heading to the window now. David Dayan, you can find him, of course, at prospect.org. You can also follow him on the Twitters at ddayan. And again, I strongly suggest you sign up for his unsanitized report. He's an investigative financial journalist and the executive editor at The American Prospect. He is also the author of 2016's Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. I have a feeling the sequel is in the works even as we speak. David Dayan, always great talking with you, my friend. We'll do it again soon.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Quick break. We're back with Desi Doyen. She always has plenty of happy talk in her Green News Report. She's always looking on the bright side, always has nothing but good news.
Oh, don't oversell.
That is straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay right there. Okay, maybe I did oversell it a little bit. Maybe it's not such great news in the Green News Report, but now that they've made it over the break and they're with us, now we can tell them the truth. Oh, it's all a disaster. No, actually, there is some good news that we referred to, including the fact, by the way, that in India, where is it? In
Yes, in Punjab, India, yeah. There's a whole big bunch of pictures floating around social media showing how, for the first time in decades, residents of Punjab can see the Himalayan mountains.
Because the skies are so clear.
Because the skies are so clear. Because of coronavirus shutdown.
Because the industry is completely shut down.
Yes.
But the good news is the sky is clear. The air is clear for a change.
Yes.
In India. And by the way, here in Los Angeles. So see, everything is fine. Buy up as much stock as you can in the stock market before you listen to our latest Green News Report.
Together, we have transformed American consciousness as to what kind of nation we can become.
Climate champion Bernie Sanders exits 2020 presidential race.
Research finds that your risk of dying from COVID-19 could skyrocket if you live in an area with long-term bad air pollution levels.
New study finds yet another reason to clear the air. Great Barrier Reef suffers another extreme bleaching event. Plus, good news for breathers as polluting coal plant closes in Kentucky.
All of that good news and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I mean, damn, those are some blue skies. I bet India probably even forgot there was a time when skies weren't gray. The same way America forgot there was a time when presidents weren't orange.
I haven't forgotten. I dream about it every night and all day and even right now. This is your Green News Report.
They used to be brown.
Okay, Desi Doyen, so Bernie Sanders is out.
Yes. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont ended his campaign for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination on Wednesday, vowing to help unify the Democratic Party to help presumptive Democratic nominee, former Vice President Joe Biden, win in November against Donald Trump. Sanders had the most progressive climate change and environmental justice policy proposals of all of the Democratic candidates.
Even more than Elizabeth Warren?
Even more than Elizabeth Warren, who was also very, very good. The policies that Bernie Sanders promoted were most aligned, however, with the speed and scope of action that scientists say is necessary to avoid climate catastrophe. In a video announcement, Sanders noted that his proposals were once considered radical, but now they are mainstream, and he encouraged his supporters to keep fighting for the progressive agenda and for climate action.
If we don't believe that we are entitled to live in a world that has a clean environment and is not ravaged by climate change, we will continue to see more drought, floods, rising sea levels, and increasingly uninhabitable planet. It was not long ago that people considered these ideas radical and fringe. Today, they are mainstream ideas, and many of them are already being implemented in cities and states across the country. That is what we have accomplished together.
Well, I guess it depends on your definition and Bernie's definition of mainstream. He has moved a lot of these ideas into closer into the mainstream, but I think that there are still people who are kind of freaked out about doing the right thing for the climate.
Indeed, there's a lot of work to be done on that front.
Well, now Bernie Sanders will have much more time to do it.
An important new study links air pollution to significantly higher death rates from the COVID-19 coronavirus. Preliminary results from the Harvard University study found that nationwide, even a small increase in particle pollution in previous years was associated with a 15% increase in the death rate from the virus. Polluted air is already known to increase the risk of premature death from chronic respiratory ailments, heart and lung diseases. The researchers calculate that slightly cleaner air in Manhattan, for example, in the past, could likely have saved hundreds of lives. The new data might also help explain, in part, why African Americans are dying from COVID-19 at much higher rates than other groups.
That would explain it.
Multiple studies have shown that polluting power plants and polluting industries are more likely to be located in communities of color, far more than white communities. The Harvard researchers say their preliminary results indicate that failure to enforce existing air pollution regulations could potentially make the COVID-19 pandemic even more deadly. And they cited the Trump EPA's recent decision to suspend enforcement of some pollution regulations during the pandemic.
Well, that would be a feature, not a bug, for the Trump administration.
In Australia, researchers confirmed that the Great Barrier Reef is now suffering its most widespread bleaching event ever recorded, and the breadth of the damage is more expansive than the most recent bleaching event in 2016.
What's a bleaching event?
A bleaching event is when warm water causes corals to expel the tiny animals that live in them, which give them color. That's why they bleach.
And die?
Making them more likely to die. A summer of extreme record-breaking heat that also triggered catastrophic deadly bushfires in Australia has also driven exceedingly warm ocean temperatures that have bleached the coral reef at an unprecedented scale along the reef's nearly 1,400-mile-long ecosystem. Finally, there is a bit of good news for breathers.
You promised.
Well, this is in Kentucky. The Tennessee Valley Authority's Paradise Coal Plant in Kentucky has officially closed. That despite pressure from the Trump administration and Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who have attempted to prop up the uneconomical coal industry that can't compete anymore against cheaper, cleaner renewables and natural gas.
Paradise lost. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, iTunes, or Google Play. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide. Help spread the word on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Thank you, Desi Doyen. But by the way, good news for the folks of Paradise, Kentucky there. If you put that story together with your earlier one about, they are with this shutdown, they may lose their jobs, I guess, but they are more likely to not die from COVID without the air pollution.
And, you know, there are long-term health benefits from reducing air pollution. And the talking about losing jobs, that is very important. And the Green New Deal framework takes care of fossil fuel workers like coal mine workers and their pensions and their health care and the retirees. So, you know, having the Green New Deal to take care of and transition these fossil fuel workers into new careers that use their skills is a good idea.
It is. And with Bernie Sanders as the next president, Oh, yeah. Where was that? On that happy note, we should get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, the American Prospects, David Dayan, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night or quarantine with us. We are honored to have you here. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it and share it with your friends and family from bradblog.com. That is free thanks to those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. And I know it's very difficult times, so we are incredibly grateful to those of you who stop by and help us stay on the air. We are 100% listener-supported radio. Could not do it without your support. Thank you. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. Find, follow, and share us there. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.